bucket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday morning. 251-343-0106. If you want to be in touch with the program, that's all you got to do. Let us know what you think. Let's see what we got here. Hold on. That's not the one. That's the one. Sorry. Barron and I are trying to work out something here with the audio. And anyway, Barron Coleman joining us here in just a moment. 251-343-0106. That's the text line. We'll see. Matt Murphy may or may not join us here on the program. He is, I'm told, in Dixon, wherever the hell that is, getting his truck fixed. So anyway, we'll stay abreast of that as that develops. You ready to go here?
Yep.
All right, let me get you potted up here. All right, I'm joining us now. Someone who's on this program from time to time, but remarkably called this 2 years ago. The assassination attempt on Donald Trump, and you and I, Barron Coleman, by the way, joining us. Barron, you and I talked about this on air, and you said, look, if Donald Trump finds himself in the place where he could be president again, it won't happen. They'll take a shot at him. And then right after that, he came on this program, and you predicted it again that, you know, they may not have connected, but that something will happen again. Now, whoever they is, you know, whatever, but what do you think where we are today on October 25th?
I mean, it looks like he is in a remarkable position electorally, a position I don't think a lot of people thought he would be in. So, you know, could Donald Trump – I moved over one to three.
Okay.
Yeah. Could Donald Trump pull it off? Could he become the next president of the United States? Right now, electorally, yeah. I mean, he'd have to win particular states. He'd have to get the job done in Georgia for sure, 100%. Pennsylvania would help. You know, you could look at the electoral map and say he needs to, you know, either win Michigan, Arizona, or Wisconsin. You know, Nevada would have to go his way. Things would have to fall his way. And Georgia, I think, is probably the biggest linchpin in him becoming the next president-elect. Whether or not he survives until January 20th, is still a question in my mind, and I don't know that is a guarantee, even if he was to pull it off.
Well, and you know, watching this, I don't think we anticipated the Democrats having this much trouble with their candidates. I think that's the flaw there, where Democrats, it was an oversight. Like, okay, well, we got a plan B if Biden doesn't work out, and sure enough, though. Kamala Harris hasn't been that great of a candidate. I don't think it's anything Donald Trump has necessarily done. He's run his typical campaign. This is third time around. She's terrible. Like, she just looks like she's, and I said this earlier in the program, and I almost feel sorry for her. Like, they put her in a place where she's not, clearly not qualified. She may be qualified to be president. I don't know. I don't think she is, but she's not qualified to run for president based on what we've seen.
I don't know why anyone would expect her to be a good candidate. And that's she's done nothing to demonstrate in the last 8 years that she would be a good candidate. She's run for office and got basically zero votes, dropped out, became a essentially a DEI hire at vice president because Joe Biden's handlers thought it would be genius for him to go out there during the primary and say, oh, I'm going to get a black woman as the vice presidential candidate. You know, for better or worse, in the Democratic Party, there aren't a lot of black women who are a plus to a presidential ticket. And so it was basically her or the, I can't remember her name right now, the war vet that's missing a leg or whatever.
Duckworth? Or
yeah, Tammy Duckworth. And, you know, that's essentially your options. And so he, you know, flip a coin, pick one of them, and Harris ended up on the ticket. But so I don't know why anyone thought she would be a good candidate. The question in my mind is, was that the plan? Was the plan here, hey, we know we can box Trump in. He's a one-term president from this point forward. We boxed him in last time through the courts. We boxed him in through Congress. We have enough Republicans who don't like him and aren't going to go along with him. Let's go ahead and give him the presidency. Let's get Harris out of the way because she was a DEI hire we did not want on the ticket to begin with. And that does away with Biden. It does away with Harris, and it does away with Trump. Now both parties are wide open in 2028.
Then if not Harris, then who?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, to me, you look at the bench, you look at your prospects, and she looks like the best bet Democrats had, and on paper, it turned out to be not the case, but I don't necessarily know that Democrats have a whole lot that they can work with right now.
For 2028?
Yeah.
Yeah, so for 2028, you've got Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania. You've got Gavin Newsom in California. These are not rock stars.
Right.
This is not Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton...
Or Barack Obama, right?
But they were not who they were until they won. You know, Bill Clinton was a philanderer with rape allegations and a governor of a little podunk, you know, third world state in Arkansas. You know, Barack Obama was a state senator who had happened into because... the Republican candidate in Illinois who was going to bludgeon him in the general election, he got kicked off because he was the state kink shamed him out of office. So he became a U.S. senator, and then he gave a nice speech and he became the president. So these people weren't who they were until they got elected either. The media machine can take somebody who's slick looking, who's attractive, and Shapiro, Newsom, you know, any of these people are attractive, good-looking candidates. They can speak well, and you put billions of dollars of free advertising behind them, and they're going to be formidable.
What do you think of this, though? Trump's elected on November 5th. He becomes president-elect. Media suddenly doesn't look as strong as it once had.
So this has always been the trouble with the media and Donald Trump. He is immune, essentially. I said in the first, 2016, 17, very early after he had been elected, maybe even before he was sworn in, but I said they're going to drive his approval ratings down to in the 20s, and then they're going to try to assassinate him. The problem is they couldn't get his approval numbers down. He'd spent 40 years building a brand as the people's guy. You know, he was in rap songs. He was in movies. There were games, there were steaks, there was wine, there was vodka. I mean,
this is just Donald Trump, and he's immune to it because of the brand he'd built over the last several decades.
Yeah, the name means excellence. In big gold letters, the name means excellence. And a lot of people kind of see through the media when they attack Trump. When the media attacks other Republicans, we sort of go along with it. But when the media attacks Trump, we're like, nah, I know who this guy is. I've known who this guy is since 84.
Well, how will they take it?
How will the media take it? In stride.
Really?
Yeah, because again, Trump, if he wins and if he remains alive, there's only so much he can do. There's only so much he can do as a president. He needs Congress to go along with it, and Congress is not immune to the media attacks, so they will not go along with it. He needs the courts. The courts are not immune to media attacks, and the courts really are unelected and cannot be removed from office in any practical way, so they don't go along with it. And I think the media survives intact, and they launch their next hate campaign against the next conservative candidate. And that the Trump phenomenon is unique in that, again, he spent 40 years building a brand of excellence and then ran for president. There's no one else like it, nor will there be.
I mean, there's no heir apparent among Republicans, then, at least because we set the bar so high for like a Trump. And they set the bar so high for like an Obama, right?
Yeah.
And everything from there is kind of downhill. So, there's nothing that has risen to that level in my mind on either side.
Yeah. There's no heir apparent to the Trump. Pence obviously didn't work out. Vance is frankly, the Democrats are right. He's a weirdo. There's just nobody coming behind him. The closest I could see to the Trump ascendancy or the Trump intellectual firepower is maybe a Tucker Carlson or someone like that. But Tucker has not spent years building a brand of excellence. He is just an intellectual workhorse who's been on the conservative side of a liberal media machine for a long time. And so we've come to kind of like him.
Now, I mean, he'll be a fixture, you know, there'll be guys like that, but what Trump did, though, he brought in this era of populism into the Republican Party that, quite frankly, I mean, the Tea Party was sort of dabbling in, but a presidential candidate. And I guess the question would be this. Does that stick with the Republicans, or do Republicans at some point in the next 20 years try to chase that away.
Well, okay, go. This is I've had this conversation with several people here recently. Go back 20 years, and you say, who is the anti-war party? Well, that's the Democrat Party.
Right.
Yeah, who's the party of the working class? That's the Democrat Party. Who's the party of big banks and intel agencies? That's the Republican Party. That is switched. You know, there was this. I've actually become fascinated with this podcast series going through the civil rights era of the late 50s to the early 70s. And there was an intellectual shift in the 1960s between the Republican and Democratic Party, whereas the Republican Party was a lot of the early civil rights leaders were Republicans, and then by the end of the 1960s, they were Democrats. The parties did switch on
that. The whole LBJ war on poverty and everything done with the civil rights era was, you know, that was a Democrat.
Yeah. Well, Trump was our LBJ. He switched us on intel, banks, trade, working class, war. Trump switched us over. After LBJ went away, and after Nixon came in, they didn't switch back. The party realignment stayed for six decades, and I it's still pretty persistent on those issues. So I think now that the party is completely switched over, I think it sort of stays.
It's kind of funny, like you bring up Nixon, but you know, Reagan or whatever. You look at a guy like Pat Buchanan, who was kind of an intellectual forefather of this whole populism movement, and he was there for that. You know, very early first transition or the latter end of it, I guess that you're referring to, but he kind of in the last 15 years was there for that switch back over, like you're talking about. And I mean, I don't know where he really made a big change. It's just, it's funny how these parties go back and forth.
Well, each party at its heart is really only worried about getting elected. Right. So What makes the Democrat Party platform solidify into a single entity? It's which positions do we have to adopt to get elected,
right?
And the Republicans largely have the same thing. Which positions do we have to adopt to get elected? And so the Republican Party has sort of become the anti-intelligence community, anti-war, anti-trade party.
Just generally, you know, conservatives are skeptical of government, right?
Should be.
And for some reason, when Bush was president, I guess it was 9/11. We were on board with NSA and all this crap with 9/11 and the Patriot Act and war and all of that. And then that just sort of wore off over time.
Well, and I think Trump brought us back to our intellectual roots, which was skepticism of big government. You know, this is a cabal of people that you don't like.
Right.
And they don't like you. And that's what it took for Republicans it finally took the way they treated Trump for it to click. They don't like us. What would they do to Jeff Poor? Exactly what they're doing to Trump times 1,000. And Trump solidified that, crystallized that in the minds of Republicans, that these people that run the government, they do not like us. We are their subjects, their slaves, their
and I, this is it's funny you say, because that's the way I think the Democrat hierarchy thinks of their base.
Oh, 100%. That's how all power views their people.
Do we really think Nancy Pelosi is, I mean, maybe she leans in that direction, but she is down with, you know, this push toward whatever the social agenda and the economic agenda. I mean, she's just like a party boss at this point, and self-enrichment and power. None of that's really necessarily connected to the what we think of when we talk about Democrats and their views on, like I said, social and economic policies.
Yeah. No, I mean, you've nailed it. They don't care. And that's, I think, what earned the loyalty to Trump. There's this perception that he does care, right? Do you think George Bush cares about any average American? No. Do you think Barack Obama cares about any average American? No. Do you think Trump cares about any average American? I mean, the last 40 years suggest he probably does. You know, did he make some mistakes along the way and say some racist or sexist things? Sure.
Well, but the thing about Trump that's different from those two is that, like, he's very in tune with what Americans think. He's marketing and branding. He understands that to some degree, and I think that works for him. Let's get a quick break in here. Baron Coleman join us here. We'll pick it up on the other side. This is the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5.
Good times, unwind, falling out of love in the same night.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for sticking with us on this Friday morning. 251-343-0106. Hit us up on the text line. We may have to scratch Matt Murphy having automobile trouble in someplace called Dixon. So we will see what we can do there. Still with us here, Baron Coleman. A few texts asking kind of what you're doing now, Baron. What's the name of your podcast, or what have you been up to since you left the Montgomery Airwaves?
I'm an in-house counsel for a tech company, and we were sort of in the startup phase. Now we're post funding, but you know, just practice law pretty much all day. Don't keep up with the news like I did. I keep one eye on the news instead of two, and I don't podcast regularly. I do guest appearances. I do interviews with people. Or I'll co-host for some, or I'll guest host for somebody, but I don't do what I used to do in having a 9 to noon daily show. Or I think I was 9 to 11 at one point, or maybe 11. I don't remember all the times I was, but, I don't do a regular show. I do have Baron Podcast reserved on YouTube and Twitter and all, and Facebook and all that. Baron Podcast. So it's certainly possible. I'm accumulating the equipment and the subscriptions necessary to get something going, but it would never be a weekly show ever again. Probably not
a daily show. Moment. You mean,
I mean a daily show. Yeah. It would probably be something weekly, maybe twice a week. Maybe one interview a week and then one sort of monologue show a week.
And for years, I mean, it was you and Jack and
yeah
I mean, that was, and you know, there wasn't a whole lot going on in Montgomery.
Well, we were going on.
Yeah, that was it. You know what I mean?
we had a lot of fun. I went through different co-hosts along the way. Jack Campbell, Ben Hagler. Unfortunately, both have passed away. That does not mean your demise is imminent, Jeff. But
I'd be with Dave Mallory watching my back there. Huh?
Yeah. If I was Dave, I would be looking left and right, because I was with Dave for a while. And then we had a recurring cast of characters that would come in. Had a lot of fun on the radio.
This is that little station there, 93.1. But people have come and gone out of there. You know, I still, Joey Clark, go every now and then when I'm in town. So then we do a regular segment back and forth, but. That, you know, at the time, we were kind of, when I first got into this, it was a weird, because none of you guys really ever intermingled. None of the talk show hosts of this state intermingled at all.
I think there was a little rivalry there for a little while. Our station, actually, Matt Murphy started on WACV, which became 93.1. It was originally 1170 AM, back 20 plus years ago when he was on. But yeah, then Greg Budell came and turned it into sort of an all day talk affair and a 24-hour talk channel. And,
it's still at it, by the way, like, you know,
yeah,
it's got a morning and afternoon drive show. And,
there was a, like I said, there was a little rivalry between the Birmingham hosts and the Montgomery hosts and the Huntsville hosts and the Montgomery hosts. They actually at one time tried to simulcast into Montgomery and, Dale and Matt and try to take us out, and it didn't work. We absolutely skull stomped them into oblivion, and they eventually had to give up their plans and leave the market within a year or so.
Well, I mean, Dale's simulcasting in Montgomery again now on WLWI. It's Kevin Elkins there still.
Yeah.
He's been there for a long time.
Yeah,
but the I'll tell you, talk radio in Alabama, but just in general, it just hasn't been the same since Rush Limbaugh died. I don't know. People, we were talking about this, Joey and I were the other day, how people are gravitating more toward like Joe Rogan and things like that, Tucker Carlson.
Well, and this is a conversation I had with the owner at WACV, that people are going into content creation more than they are terrestrial radio.
Right.
And so you have to be able to create both.
All right, let's get a break in here. Baron Coleman sitting in here while we're broadcasting from Nashville. Things kind of coming and going with the internet connection, such as it is. But we'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Or I may simply be a single drop of rain, but I will.
Inside my head. Welcome back to to the Jeff Porter Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us. 251-343-0106 is the text line. Need me in touch with the show? Text. We ought to have some time toward the end of the program. We'll be wide open. So just keep feeding me the ball, if you will, and we'll respond to whatever it is that's on your mind. Still sitting in with us here, Baron Coleman, who I got to know during his Montgomery radio days. He has certainly a track record long before that as well, just kind of in and out of the Alabama political scene. And you don't keep up with much of that anymore, do you, Baron, with what's going on in Montgomery?
Not a lot. I can tell you who the speaker is and who the Senate pro tem is and who the governor is. I don't keep up with day-to-day what's going on and who's pulling the strings and what bills are coming up and who's killing it. I used to love that. We were talking during the break when Jack and I started the show originally. It was an Alabama politics-based show. It was not a national show. We very rarely mentioned national politics. Trump kind of changed that because the Trump phenomenon and the Trump story was so unbelievable you couldn't avoid it. And we got away from state politics a little bit. A couple years into the Trump administration, we sort of focused back on local politics. But no, since moving to Nashville, I've really left it behind.
Because I did this. I lived in D.C. and I got to see the D.C. celebrities and, you know, all the bars and all the restaurants and all the places they go. And it doesn't impress me. When I first moved up there, I was like just taken aback by all that. I thought, oh, this is cool. I saw David Gregory of it, you know, in the grocery store or whatever. And then like after a while, it just realize these guys are kind of douchebags. You don't want to get the hell out of town. But like when I got back into the Alabama game, and this was what brought it, was the Doug Jones Roy Moore race in 17, and then I just sort of went from there. But it's just, it was such a more, like, you're just closer to the action, you understand it. It took me 20 years to understand Alabama. Alabama's a weird state, 67 counties. And you finally kind of get a grasp of it. And once you understand how everything kind of works and how people work together and all the different power brokers, it's way more fascinating to me than federal politics.
Alabama politics is its own animal. And I think most states are this way. I think Tennessee's this way. I think Indiana was this way when we lived up there. I didn't really pay attention to Florida politics much when we lived down there, but the state is run by people you've never heard of and you don't know, right? Landowners, industry titans, bankers, hospital systems. That's who's running the show. Insurance companies. They're doing it through the individuals who happen to end up on your ballot.
They're intermediaries.
Yeah.
And I always said this, like a lot of what goes on in the state, and it's been this true since the Civil War. It's the planters and the big mules, right? They just take on different forms. The planters are still the farmers and big ag, but the big mules, those towers in Birmingham and the corporate boardrooms there, you know, it's Alabama Power, it's the banks, it's, you know, those guys are first in line to get what they want. What changed, though, for a brief period, Baron, and you were kind of involved, I think the teachers union and Paul Hubbard just, like, really figured out, and they got to the front place in line, and then 2010 was that sort of breaking point when the big mules used a political wave to strike back.
Strike back against the teachers union?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's always money driven, right? If you get into power, we were talking about this in the first segment. If you get into power, you want to stay in power. That's what political parties are designed to do. Adopt positions that keep you in power. Republicans aren't conservative because they think it's the right thing to do. They're that maybe the rank and file are, but the big party bosses of the Republican Party are conservative because that's what keeps them elected. That's what keeps the money flowing. If you are an industry titan, if you're in health insurance, if you are in banking, whatever, you need to compete against other banks, compete against other health insurance companies, but you also need to rig government in a way that benefits you.
And then they do it really, really well in Alabama.
Yeah, the teachers union came along in the 1960s, and again, that was just a way for people to get power. They didn't really care about the teachers.
They weren't. So the teachers union and the big mules never were head-to-head over any,
Not often.
You know, but they didn't want to have to wait in line because unless the AEA got what it wanted first, they would hold up everything else.
Yeah, because, again, it was a way to get money and power into the party because you had hundreds of thousands of people who could donate $2 or $3 a month, and all of a sudden you could pay to have anyone in the state house elected. We could buy any seat we want. We go buy a critical mass of House seats. Now we own the House. We go then buy a critical mass a couple elections later of Senate seats. Now we own the Senate. Now we're going to go buy the governorship, and now the AEA controls everything. The Teachers Association, Teachers Union, whatever you want to call them, they now control everything. Again, did the people who came up with that plan care about teachers? Probably not. They looked at it as a massive well of money to accumulate power. And that is the same thing everywhere. That's how state governments run.
But this is what they're afraid of now, that gambling will, and not necessarily like gambling, but the, like the Porch Creek Indians or whatever will become the new AEA. And I think this is part of the reason why we don't have gambling yet in Alabama, is there's this, at least this fear that if you legalize gambling and you have a new big mule and you really want to share that rarefied air with a gambling lobby, and I think a lot of people say no.
Yeah, and it's a lesson from the teachers' lobby. Did the banks and the agriculture and the big forestry, did they all want to share the seat at the table with yet another group, the teachers' union? No, but they had to, and they did it for decades. They don't want to do it again. It's not a moral issue with gambling. I have a moral issue with gambling, a personal moral issue with gambling. It's not a moral issue with gambling with those people. They don't have moral issues. It's a power issue, and they don't want to cede a seat at the table to another group.
But you have this, where we don't want to cede the seat at the table, plus the people who are opposing it because of the moral issue. And you bring those two together, it's hard to beat.
Yeah, very hard to beat. Very hard to beat. So you prey on the moral issues of people like me to keep the seat at the table empty. Because again, it's not just, hey, I want to be powerful. It's, hey, I represent bankers. And I don't know what the gambling people's view is on bankers, but I know if they're electing people, they may be hostile to my bankers' positions. So I want to keep them illegal, keep them out of here, out of politics, keep them away from the table, keep them poor so that my banker continues to get his way. On the off chance they end up disagreeing with me if they go.
I think that's so much of what goes on in Montgomery. It's just sort of like, well, I don't know about this new entity coming into our turf and taking some, because you know, it's not like with power, there's only so many pieces of the pie you could distribute, and they don't want a smaller piece of the pie.
Yeah, 100%. And you mentioned the Porch Creek in particular. I don't have any problem in the world with Porch Creek. I think they're incredibly generous. They are incredibly altruistic in a lot of ways. They give a lot of money away. They take care of a lot of people. I just am not wild about somebody putting their paycheck up, and then I know it's an addiction and all that. And the Porch Creek happened to that. That's one aspect of their business, but they do a lot of good things. And so it's not a knock on gamblers. I actually loved Milton McGregor when he was alive. I'd go sit at his house. We'd talk. I'd go sit in his office. We'd talk. But I didn't love the fact that a portion of his financial empire was tied to gambling.
I mean, we have such a checkered history in Alabama with gambling, and I get it. Like, we're one of the last few states where there's no, like, real legalized gambling, no lottery or whatever. I mean, there's still some sort of pseudo gambling in Alabama, but it's the sins of Phoenix City and, you know, and this sort of the reputation, I think, that holds it back. It's not that we're a bunch of Bible thumpers that think that Jesus is going to come or that God's going to come and wash away the land if we have gambling. It's just kind of knowing, like, these guys don't always operate on the up and up.
Yeah, I mean, the up and up, certainly part of it. But again, it's if you're the Forestry Association, if you're the Bankers Association, if you're the Insurance Association, if you're the whatever association, do you want to cede influence to the state legislature and the governor's office to people you don't know about? You don't know what they are. They might be great on your issues. They might not be. But what we don't want to do is make them even wealthier so that they have even more influence in this place.
Well, yeah, and you look at the BCA could now compared to back like 2010, 2011 when Bill Canary ran it, and they were on the outside looking in some ways. Now they're kind of at the front of the line. I'm just, you know, I don't think it's like necessarily they have any moral objection to it at all. And you always hear these arguments, well, we got to pass it because we can raise money for the school kids or whatever. But it's like that is such a, like, just a veneer. Like, what's going on and the way these people operate, I don't think people really fully, maybe they never will in the state, but they really fully comprehend, like, really the whole calculus with the power or any of that. The public just, it's too black and white to them, and it's not, they keep it this way too, right? They don't let them, they don't explain the grays and ways we're talking about.
No, they don't. And again, part of that is they want to keep people not dumb or stupid, but ignorant on it. They want to keep people uninformed on these issues, because if you have an informed population, now you can't control how they vote. And this thing probably will end up on a ballot at some point. Sorry. Don't have my own cough button. This thing probably will end up on a ballot at some point. And if we want to keep gambling in the recesses and poor and marginally effective in the state, then we need to keep people uneducated on it. Why? Because they have jobs, they have children, they have lives, they go to volleyball games, they take their kids to the Friday night football games. They don't have time to sit around and study the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. They don't have time to sit around and read 1,000-page lottery bills. They don't have time to do all this. So we'll keep them ignorant on it. When it comes up for a vote, we'll just scare them into voting no.
No, it's just like, I think people just really want to vote on a lottery. I mean, I what I hate about it is we don't have the discussions. It's so dumbed down. And, well, my constituents just want to vote on a lottery or whatever. And there's so much more to it. And some of it may be good. Some of it's really, really rotten, you know. And that's why I preach this on the show all the time, but it's this sort of silly talking point, and it's hard to overcome sometimes.
Well, you think about any issue where it polls very high. The lottery has polled in the 70s or 80s since I started tracking it 10, 15 years ago. A single issue vote on a lottery is very, very popular. So if you're trying to get elected or you're trying to win people over, what do you go? You go around and say, well, I want my people to vote on a lottery, because that polls at 75% on average. Same thing with increased minimum wage. $15 minimum wage polls 60-70%. So if you're just pandering to people, you say, well, I want a $15 minimum wage. And people go, yeah, that makes sense. What you don't talk about is the economic consequences of a $15 minimum wage, how every time we raise the minimum wage, the economy actually gets worse. People lose their job. Unemployment goes up. Inflation goes up. I mean, the negative consequences are terrifying. Same thing with lotteries. You bring a lottery in, all of a sudden poverty goes up. Crime goes up. There are negative consequences.
Homelessness, like, you know, yeah. You know, you go to these places. I mean, not necessarily the lottery, but like if you do some kind of legalized institutional casino gambling and in this state, it won't be, hey, let's try the free market out. It's going to be very, very government controlled, and it's going to be, you know, the haves and have-nots, and then picking winners and losers. But you look over at Biloxi, Mississippi, compared to Mobile, Alabama, and it's just homelessness all over the place. And you know, at some point, Baron, they were bringing their homeless to Mobile and dropping them off.
Yeah.
And I don't think people realize. Yeah, you should have the freedom to do whatever you want to with your own money. But we have to have a discussion about the consequences when you make a big social change like that.
Well, it's like anything. You know, if you have children and they're teenagers, you don't want them doing drugs. Why? Not because the first time they do drugs, they're probably going to ruin their life. But drug users, on the whole, are worse off than people who don't do drugs. Heavy gamblers, on the whole, are worse off than people who are not heavy gamblers. So if we want to protect people from themselves, and that's what every law is, it's a moral decision on how to protect people from themselves. Why can't we speed? It's my car. I should be able to go 95 down the interstate. Yeah, but you're putting yourself in jeopardy, and you're putting other people in jeopardy. Why do I have to wear a seatbelt? You're putting yourself, you're putting other people in jeopardy. There's this idea that laws are somehow God-ordained and He knows to keep it away from moral issues. Every law is a decision on a moral issue made by a small group of people that will apply to everyone. The same thing with gambling, the same thing with alcohol, the same thing with drugs. We have these vices. We have human nature is what it is. And if you allow people to become addicted to something, it will destroy their lives in all likelihood. And then we as a community have to pay for that.
Well, and it's also this, and the difficulty in getting gambling in Alabama is twofold. Like we just mentioned, the whole power struggle. But at one point in time, we had the Constitution of Alabama Convention in 1901, and they put that in language in there. I mean, and then the legislature, and they gave the voters a chance in 1999, and they said no to it. It's kind of the government we deserve. Somewhere along the way, we decided this, and you know, we're living with it, and there's an avenue to change it, but they missed it by one Senate vote last time around. It just never quite gets there, and that's what people like who get frustrated with all of this, and why don't we just do it? Well, but this is what we agreed to. This was the social contract. This is what we agreed to as a state of Alabama. And that's why, like, I think in some ways you got to be kind of okay with the way things are. If you don't like the way your lawmaker voted on gambling,
pull them out. Yeah. I'm a process guy, more than a substance guy on a lot of this stuff. If the process is followed and the state decides they want to go all in on gambling, great. Let's try to make it as safe and fair as possible. I would probably vote against such a thing. But if the process is followed, I'm fine with it.
I tell you, I just, the other thing I would caution people is like, you think you're going to get something that's wholesome and above board. There's a long history in the state of Alabama of people not really playing by the rules. Just be aware, you know, buyer beware.
No, and that is, I don't want to go down that road on it because I don't want to say gambling is necessarily run by immoral people, because I do think there are moral people who or can be bartenders or can be bar owners or can be gambling casino hall owners. And you could still be a moral person, even though.
Well, just be cautious, be aware. I mean, it's quite possible. Let's get a quick break in here. Baron Coleman's still sitting in with us. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.
I'll never forget it.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for sticking around. Murphy is scratched from the lineup. Will join us 9 o'clock on Monday, he says. So anybody out there that cares about that, we're wide open for the rest of the program. 251-343-0106. Baron Coleman's still sitting in with us here for a few more minutes. Here we go. James, the official troll of the Jeff Poor Show. Nanny state, so basically Alabama, has decided that their citizens are not capable of being accountable for their own decisions. It's bad, but Alabama allows predatory loans for the poor. It's disgusting. With predatory loans, I don't know, but with gambling, they're selling you kind of a false hope too, you know, much. There's not really a moral equivalence there.
Well, we've decided that 18-year-olds can't drink alcohol, right? Are we a nanny state? I don't know. It's around vices. We put limitations, right? And gambling is one of them.
We outlaw drugs. You know, there's all kinds of things. Yeah.
We've decided people can't use methamphetamines and heroin at the same time and drive down the highway. Are we a nanny state? You know, you might be able to handle it, right? You might not put people in jeopardy, but on the whole, if you allowed people to use methamphetamines and heroin willy-nilly in the state of Alabama, the state would be worse off. And the state has decided for the time being gambling fits into that category. If you don't like it, again, I'm a process guy. Follow the process. Elect someone in your district who will support gambling, and then go to Montgomery and get it put on the ballot. And then when it's on there, vote for it.
Or if it's something you really covet, move to Mississippi. You have everything you could get there. And that's only like a half hour away.
Yeah.
For a lot of you. But what I hate is that mentality that you don't think that we can handle this, or you know, it's a free country, go do what you want to do. There's places where you can go do all this stuff. Alabama has chosen not to, and it gets back to the process.
Yeah. So, but that's every law is that way. You know, why can you not fish without a license? Oh, they don't trust me to catch a bass. No, I mean, we have to maintain the fishes and the waterways. And, you know, there are consequences if everybody was able to stick a putt. Is it silly? Yeah, probably, you know, but it's the law. And if you don't like it, there's a process. Change it.
Yeah, change the process and don't gripe about it. But, you know, you look at Alabama, it's just there is a balance there. And it's sort of what our expectations of what the public will do, and then kind of how much freedom, you know, and how much freedom you give people to live their own lives. We don't, like you see, don't legalize heroin or whatever. It's just some really dangerous things. And they impair your decision-making. And we were talking about this, too, during the break. Like, gambling can really impair your decision making, and they prey off of that. And I just, you know, I don't think that necessarily Big Brother or nanny statism is at play here, but there are public health crises created from, there are consequences from gambling.
Yeah, if you've ever gambled regularly, and we were talking during the break, if you've ever gambled regularly, you know there's a biochemical response to gambling. And that's what the state's protecting against now. Now you can change it, but that now is the justification.
Baron, we're out of time, but I do appreciate you giving us an hour of your day and stopping by, and we'll do it again sometime.
I've enjoyed it, Jeff. Thank you.
Baron Coleman, we'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Carry on, sweet southern comfort, carry on.